From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the August 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast, Inspiring Women. This month we delve into cybersecurity, the pioneering work women did at Bletchley Park during World War II, and we listen in on a heartwarming conversation between the architect who led the restoration of Bletchley Park and the Hut 6 veteran who inspired her. McAfee has officially opened its international cybersecurity exhibition titled Secrecy and Security, Keeping Safe Online and the Computer Learning Zone at Bletchley Park. Workshops will be held as well, teaching visitors about the ever-evolving cyber threat. And another element of the partnership is McAfee's Online Safety for Kids program, which sees McAfee staff volunteer to teach courses on safely navigating cyberspace. The company also sponsors an online safety education officer who will deliver a Safety for Kids program to schools visiting Bletchley Park, as well as providing e-learning strategies, advice and training. This huge package was launched in the ballroom with help from veteran Betty Webb.
Welcome to Bletchley Park.
My name is Ross Allen, Vice President for McAfee in the United Kingdom, Ireland, and by my accent, Canada as well. Today we're here to announce the opening of McAfee's Computer Learning Center and Cyber Learning Zone here in Block C. That started about a year ago. I attended a session where Ian Standen was presenting to a group of individuals about the current state of Bletchley Park and the restoration of this national institution. And what really came out of that was a cry for help. And it culminated last October in the announcement of a five-year partnership between McAfee and Bletchley Park. In that five-year partnership, one of the largest donations we've given outside of the United States was really to focus on three things. The first was the provision of the Cybersecurity Center, which is in Block C, which was designed for all visitors of all ages to learn about the importance of online safety and security. The second was the provision of a cyber learning zone, and we've hired a full-time educational officer in Nicola Halls, who's standing right there, and with the objective of teaching the expected 16,000 children that will be visiting the Bletchley site. And the third piece was really the extension of the Online Safety for Kids program of McAfee, to take that program out to the schools and help parents and teachers and children about the importance of cyber learning and cybersecurity. You know, there's a natural affinity with Bletchley Park and McAfee. Bletchley Park, the home of the original code breakers, or hackers we call them today, breaking the Enigma machine, and has been accredited with ending the Second World War a full 2 years earlier by these interceptions and translations and hackings that enabled us to ultimate victory in World War II. Important for us is the opportunity to teach the next generation of cyber learning and cyber education. And that's really the objective of our partnership with Bletchley Park. But McAfee's role extends beyond that to the provision of security for the state and critical infrastructure, as well as businesses and the protection of their businesses and intellectual property. But today it's about educating the next generation in cybersecurity. And I think the special treat for you is an interview with Betty Webb, who's a veteran of Bletchley Park. We'll get a chance to really learn about her role and the importance that women played in breaking the codes of Enigma and helping the war effort here on the home front. Let me again thank you for coming. Hope you'll find it a rewarding and interesting experience. It is for us, and we just couldn't be more pleased to be associated with Bletchley Park. So with that, let me announce Sir John Scarlett to pick it up from here. Sir John?
My role, briefly, is to just remind you of where you are and what it is about Bletchley Park that really does make it unique. This is the site, and this is the place where truly great events, great achievements happened in this place, in this building, on this site, in these huts, in these blocks. The contribution to victory in World War II, and of course the ushering in of the technological revolution and the IT age. By any standards, this is a big deal to talk about such subjects. These are not routine issues. 2 weeks ago, on the 18th of June, we ushered in a new age for Bletchley Park and the Bletchley Park Trust with the relaunch of our regenerated site, which you can see around you. It's quite hard for you, unless you've been here before, to realise what it was like when it wasn't regenerated. And of course, symbolised on this occasion by HRH, the Duchess of Cambridge, whose grandmother and great aunt, twin sisters, worked here in 1944 and 1945. So that's a pretty special thing. And then, of course, now we have the McAfee exhibition. First of all, I just want to remind you of the history, because that is fundamentally what it is about. Now, on the 12th of July, 1945, General Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, wrote a letter to my predecessor as the Chief of Secret Intelligence Service, Major General Mingus, the third Chief of the Service. I was the 14th, so there's a bit of a gap between us, some 60 years, but still, all the same, I feel the connection, in which he asked for his special thanks to be passed to the staff of Bletchley Park. And he explained in the letter how the intelligence from Bletchley Park has been of priceless value to me. It has saved thousands of British and American lives, and it contributed to the speed with which the enemy was routed and eventually forced to surrender. That's a direct quote from the letter. I had that hanging in my office. I was very proud of it hanging in my office, but I didn't entirely understand what it quite meant. With hindsight, you can see, I think, perhaps, that the reference to saving thousands of lives was almost certainly an understatement, if we accept, as quite serious historical study does, that the contributions to a whole series of campaigns in the Second World War were, as we believe them to have been, from the code breaking here, shortening the war. I mean, maybe it was 18 months, maybe it was 2 years, who knows? It's hard to be sure. But given the scale of the catastrophe in the Second World War, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of lives, not to mention the future course of history, was affected by the shortening of the war. So again, you know, this is not a small matter. It's a big deal. Just reflecting on my own knowledge of the situation and of the history, and also a whole series of very serious historical studies, it is absolutely possible to show that the intelligence that came from breaking into, first of all, the Enigma cipher, and then Lorenz from 1942, really, 43 onwards, but reaching a culmination in 1944 in the run-up to D-Day between Hitler and his senior field commanders, made a possibly critical difference to the conduct of the campaigns in North Africa in 1941-1942. General Auchinleck said, if it hadn't been for Ultra, Rommel would have got through to Cairo. Certainly immeasurably impacted on the successful outcome in 1943 of the Battle of the Atlantic. And then, of course, famously in Normandy in 1944, the impact on the success of the D-Day landings, which, of course, now we assume were bound to be successful. The commanders at the time certainly didn't assume it was bound to be successful, and it was extremely touch and go. The intelligence that came from here on enemy dispositions right the way along the northern French coast, but, of course, not just that, but also the deception operations that were enabled through the double cross system, which were only possible because of the break here into the top secret communications of the German intelligence service, the Abwehr, allowed those double cross operations to happen successfully. I'll tell you from experience, you can't run double agent operations unless you know that the other side is believing what you're reporting down the line. And of course, rather exceptionally, in 1944-45, we did know, because of the work done here. And it was that work that really led to the creation of the world's first semi-programmable computer, Colossus, and as often happens in times of extreme conflict, ushered in major technological change. So this is a special place by any standards. We're very pleased to be working now with McAfee on an exhibition which clearly draws in a whole number of ways on the traditions and histories and lessons of Bletchley Park and the skills that the United Kingdom has to offer across a whole range of technological communications, IT issues. Now, the particular emphasis, and it's very important here, is on education and then online safety for young children. I've got a strong personal interest in this as the father of four children, and I have to admit, of seven, soon to be eight grandchildren. Day by day, I see the importance of this, and I see what an enormous challenge it is for parents, for families, for schools. We're sort of beginning to meet it, but only beginning to meet it. And I find it very difficult, and I know that the parents of young children do too. We all laugh about young children being ahead of the IT, ahead of their parents, and certainly their grandparents. But it's not a joke, actually. It's a serious issue. And so the fact that we here are able, with McAfee, to contribute on this, I take as a particularly important point. And the other particular theme I want to bring out is, of course, that we're anxious to put across the role that women have played in the history that I've been talking about, and also, of course, in the present and in the future in the IT sector overall, but in cybersecurity in particular. First of all, we're very honoured to have Betty Webb with us, and thank you very much indeed. You look as if you're ready for action down there, which is splendid. And I referred already to the critical breakthrough which happened in December 1941 into the top secret Enigma-driven communications of the Abwehr. This was done by a very small team, the famous Dilly Knox, but his two key assistants, Mavis Beatty and Margaret Rock, they were code breakers working at the very centre of the operation, which impacted 2.5 years later in the successful landings in Normandy. I mentioned Joan Murray, critical work along with Alan Turing on naval Enigma. So along with meeting Betty, I wanted to remind you of the role that these people have played. And when the Duchess of Cambridge came 2 weeks ago, she met veterans from Bletchley Park, and actually they were all women. It was a great pleasure to see those exchanges going on. That sets the context. It is now up to Raj Samani, the CTO at McAfee, to take you into the subject matter. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Thank you, Sir John. First of all, I'd like to echo the sentiments of both Ross and Sir John. When we look at the environment we live in today, children are on the internet. It's not like televisions. You know, it was a one-way communication flow. People can talk back now. We did a study last year as part of the research, and we found that, you know, 1 in 6 parents don't believe they have the right education or knowledge to be able to have a conversation with their children about online safety. And where do they go for help? Did you know almost 43% of parents, their first port of call is Google? So having somewhere where children and parents and school teachers alike can go to is absolutely imperative. We asked children between 8 and 11 to submit their cybersecurity superhero. The winner is Kirsten Holly from Little Paxton Primary School in Cambridge. But I tell you what I really like. She actually has a bubble machine. And that bubble machine will actually capture the bad messages on the internet. She's actually got a pair of glasses which can see every computer in the world. Now, for those privacy advocates, we've got nothing to do with that at all. She's actually won the opportunity for her entire class to come to Bletchley Park, and they'll take part in McAfee's Computer Learning Suite. I think getting youngsters to understand the importance of cybersecurity is so important. So the fact we had only one winner detracts from the fact that we had over 500 entries. You know, just think, there were 500 other children that took the time out to start to think about the importance of cybersecurity. All of the children that contributed were all winners. Having a centre and having a hub like the Bletchley Park Trust here is of paramount importance. So hopefully we can now begin to get the dialogue about online safety for children, for both parents, school children, and teachers alike. With that in mind, I'd like to introduce Natalie Black, the Deputy Director for Cyber Defence and Internet Management at the Cabinet Office.
This is fantastic. This is exactly the kind of creativity we're looking for in cybersecurity. And thank you very much for inviting me to join this event today. It's my third trip to Bletchley Park, and every time it just gets better and better, and I think we'll see more of that today. It goes without saying that the government takes cybersecurity incredibly seriously. We're investing £860 million over the course of 5 years, and we already have quite a lot to show for it, both in terms of the Cyber Streetwise campaign, which I hope many of you have seen in person, but we've also recently launched Cert UK, which is a new organisation to manage national cyber incidents. But a key tenet of the national cybersecurity strategy is developing the cybersecurity skills we need to keep the UK safe. And to do that, we have to work together. We have to work with industry and academia. This area is incredibly challenging, and we cannot afford to leave anyone on the sidelines. Bletchley is a great reminder of what we can do collectively in the UK when we all work together and pool our talent. At the moment, we are working very hard to develop a pipeline of cyber talent. I hope that you've seen the initiatives that we've launched across different areas of the curriculum to include cyber. We're working hard with eSkills to give people the opportunity to transfer to cyber careers. And very soon we'll be launching a new initiative with the Open University, where we hope to allow 200,000 people to study cybersecurity online. But we do know that there are not enough women working in cybersecurity, and we're therefore working very hard with organisations like the Women's Security Society, Women in Security, to promote cyber careers. And just recently, the Chancellor launched a new initiative as a call to action to get more women involved in technology and engineering. But there are encouraging signs, and I hope a lot of you noticed that in the last cybersecurity challenge for schools, the competition was won by an all-girls team from Stockport. Given that we do have this challenge, we still have to recognise the massive contribution women have already made, both in the past, through people like Betty, and I have to say my last time I was here, I sat at a lunch right next to her, and I'm afraid I was incredibly rude. I didn't talk to anyone else because she was just fascinating. And then a pun for a book, I went and bought it straight away and read it that night. It was really, really inspiring. And those are the kinds of stories that we need to keep telling. But we also need to recognise those women who are already working in cybersecurity. So it's my great pleasure to introduce not only Betty, but also Samantha Humphrey-Swift from McAfee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Samantha Humphrey-Swift, and I'm a manager in McAfee Labs. I've been with McAfee for nearly 15 years now, and I've really seen the industry change and grow during this time. The part of the organisation that I work in analyses code data for many, many thousands of new threats that we see every single day. And we're also responsible for the vast infrastructure that's needed to analyse and respond to over 90 billion queries that come in through the McAfee network. And we've done some research recently around women in technology. This is quite shocking, actually, I think. We spoke to some members of the British public to gauge their awareness of women in technology. 72% of the nation didn't recognise the names of some very prolific women working in the technology field today. That's quite a big number. And actually, when we look at the balance, it was more women that couldn't recognise these women than it was guys. So there's certainly here some work to be done. Without further ado, though, I'm honoured to be on stage here with the marvellous Betty Webb, one of the original female cyber defenders. How did you come to be here working at Bletchley Park?
Well, I've been trying to find out ever since. 73 years on, and people still ask me this question. And I honestly do not know why I was selected, except possibly because I'm bilingual. I think they probably thought I was good enough to come to Bletchley and do some translating. But in fact, I didn't in the end. I did other things. But to answer your question, I think that is probably why I was selected. But none of us really knew, apart from senior people, of course. I'd done my training in the Auxiliary Territorial Service, and then it was a question of whether you want to be a gunner or a cook, and I said I didn't know, and the next thing I knew I was being interviewed in London and given a railway warrant to come to Bletchley, about which I had never heard, and I certainly didn't know what was going on behind the wire fence.
When we spoke the other day, you mentioned part of the recruitment process that you thought may have something to do with being able to do the Telegraph crossword very quickly.
Well, I didn't actually do that, but I understand that some people were invited to do that. I think they had to do it in 12 minutes, and if they did, they were then interviewed as being possible codebreakers.
Fabulous. So what was life like here when you were at Bletchley?
Well, it was very mixed in that we had a fairly strict work schedule. A shift system which was either from 8 till 4 or 4 to midnight or midnight to 8, so that one was physically quite tired at the end of the session. We did have a day off occasionally if duties allowed, but that side of it of course was fairly exacting, and also we didn't know, as a junior person, I was very junior, I had no idea what was going on in the next room, never mind the rest of the park. But we had a very good social life as well. Sport was laid on, and we had a choir run by a professional musician. We had a magical society, not so professional, but great fun. And we had the drama group, who managed to put on a play about every 3 months. So looking at the whole picture, recreation was good, work was hard, but it was a balanced life.
And you really didn't know sort of what else was going on here?
No, yeah. As I said, as a junior person, I had no idea. I know a bit more now because I've done a bit of research and I put the picture together. But at the time, I had no idea of its importance.
So looking back, 75% of the people that worked here were women.
Yes.
Do you think that women are involved in technology enough these days?
Oh, no, they're not. Mm-hmm. And I think they're a bit frightened of it, actually. But I do try and tell people that these posts are available and wanted. And when I talk to schools, as I do, I'm doing much more now, I always mention that there is this need for more women to go in for cybersecurity matters.
Certainly, I've always felt that, you know, the right person should do the right job, no matter whether or not they're male or
absolutely,
female.
Absolutely, absolutely. When we were here, we were told that women couldn't be code breakers, but that was proved to be quite wrong.
Very much so. So how have you seen the technology industry change over the years?
Well, bearing in mind I've been on this planet rather longer than you have, I see great changes because I was brought up in the country and we were one of the first people to have a telephone. And communication was on foot usually. So that all these developments are quite amazing to me. And I also see the great need for children to be involved. And indeed they are. The schools are much more awake now. I spoke to two schools last week, and the interest by 14, 16-year-olds is becoming much better.
So how do you think we can get more women involved in the technology industry today?
Well, it's got to be by education, obviously, and I think perhaps they ought to come to Bletchley Park.
They absolutely should, and come and see the cybersecurity exhibition.
Absolutely, yes, yes. No, well, I mean, it's like anything else. If they only imagine what it's like, they get the wrong picture. So they must come. But unfortunately, for some of the schools, I was talking to some in Worcester recently who are trying to get a slot to come and see Bletchley, and they're told that we're fully booked until September next year, which is wonderful. But it does mean that the children have to wait.
Betty, it's been marvellous talking to you. Thank you very much for your contribution here at Bletchley.
I'm
very, very, very honoured to be here on stage with you. Thank you.
So I've taken the opportunity to come and sit out in the grounds of Bletchley Park, because it's not very often we get nice weather in this country. Raj, your speech earlier, I think you gave a really great example of why cybersecurity is so important, especially starting early with school children, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the story basically centred around a piece of work we did with the Anti-Bullying Alliance. And what happened was a young boy puts his hand up and says, you know, he and his friend went to go and meet what they thought was an 11-year-old girl, and it turned out to be a 33-year-old man. And what shocked all of us was other children found it funny. And he actually didn't tell his parents, he didn't tell the school teachers, or he didn't tell anybody. And that was the first time he actually raised it. So, you know, getting children to understand online dangers, but also providing a resource where parents and teachers can go to, you know, when their children do come up with these examples, then they know what to do, is so important.
It's good that you're not just selling software, you're doing something good for future generations and trying to save people, you know, what could be terrible incidents, really. If that boy hadn't taken his friend with him, you know, we don't know what would have happened. But if there's any one thing that you would want people to take away as a piece of advice, what would it be?
The most important thing I would stress here is the internet is a wonderful, wonderful resource. You know, I remember when I was going to school, we'd have to photocopy entire reams of books. And the internet gives information to children, to all of us. It's at our fingertips. But, you know, like a wonderful opportunity, like things like cars, there are dangers associated with it. So the most important thing is, listen, don't stop your children going to these resources, but do so in a safe environment.
So, Nicola, I can't think of anyone who would have started a new job under such a glare of media as you have, really. Was it your first week and we had the royal visit?
Not quite, but we've had a few events and, yeah, it's been interesting. It's also been a quick way to get kind of up to date with everything, which is quite nice. But yeah, it's been quick work.
What probably a lot of people don't realise is that McAfee are not just sponsoring this new exhibit, but also your role, aren't they?
Yeah, my role as the online safety officer for Bletchley Park. My role is to provide an interactive and like a person resource for the schools and children who are actually coming here and the visitors as well, to provide additional information if they require it or someone to talk to about experiences and to get extra information.
It's not just an exhibit. People come here and there's a human being that they can interact with, and parents can bring their children here and school groups can come here, and you're there to help them, aren't you?
Yeah, I run online safety workshops for particular age groups, or for parents or for the over 65s, going through quite a lot of topics that maybe it comes up if someone mentions something happened to them. We can then take the time apart to talk about that particular situation and what could be done and what should have been done and stuff like that. So it's a very personalised time and resource for them, yeah.
So you started, you've had a royal visit, and you get to work in one of the best places I can imagine to work in. Things going quite well?
Yeah, pretty good, actually. Yeah, the department I work in within education, everyone there is wonderful. Everyone here at Bletchley and at McAfee have been so open and supportive and providing lots and lots of information and help whilst I get up and running. It's been great.
And Raj, this isn't just a quick bit of publicity from McAfee, is it?
This is absolutely a long-term investment. It's more than an exhibit. Mm. It's, you know, because you can go to most places and get an exhibit. But I think when children do come here, it's having that interactive session, somebody to talk to. That's the draw, I think. Cyber, or rather the internet, is going to be so central to our lives. This isn't something that we can just, you know, throw somebody in for 3 months or, you know, build an exhibit and then walk away. We're in this for the long haul.
The latest in the Bletchley Park Presents series of talks was from the real women of Bletchley Park, four women whose diverse roles within the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II gave a rare insight into the inner workings of this top-secret organisation. Ruth Bourne, Charlotte Webb, Gwendolyn Page and Jean Valentine kept their extraordinary war work secret for another 30 years, but now they can tell all, and they did so to a sold-out crowd in the ballroom.
Ladies, thank you very much indeed. Next, we have questions. Okay, well, I can target this one very definitely. Why was there a visit to the German submarine?
We had been working on the German signals, and of course, we knew quite a lot about them and with the new things that the Germans were bringing out. And this submarine happened to be captured towards the end of the war and brought into the Thames. And I think it was because of the snorkel devices and things like that, we were allowed to go and look over it. So we feel that it was a little thank you.
Thank you very much. The bomb machines have got electrical connections on the back, but the first bomb machine was rather different with the way that they are attached, is that right?
There are 12 miles of wire in the bomb machine with all the leads and things at the back. I don't know what else I can tell you.
Perhaps if I have a go at this one. The first machine was very much a prototype. Yes. It was called Victory and didn't really live up to its name because it sort of had far too many stops and that sort of thing. There was an element of redesign simply between Victory and the rest of the machines that came on afterwards, starting with Agnes, which was installed in late 1940. But unfortunately, I can't actually answer why there was a difference in the connection in the back. Okay, did anyone work with Harry Hinsley? And that's probably more likely to be you, Betty.
No, I didn't. I met him once, but I didn't work with him.
Right, ladies. Did you talk about your work? Did you talk about who was in what hut and what they were doing and that sort of thing? Did you exchange information? Anybody? Ruth, we haven't had one from you yet. Why don't you answer that one?
Well, as I understand it, even within the huts, I was told, from one room to another, people didn't necessarily know what each one was doing. I did go to a reunion when we had reunions in Bedford, and we were given a talk by a gentleman who worked in the hut for several months before he knew what was going on in the hut next door to which he was connected. And in fact, I'm also told that initially, Hut 11, where the bombs were, they also had checking machines and they would phone through their stops to Hut 6 on this scrambler phone. But in fact, if you go round the corner, you'll see that Hut 6 and Hut 11 are just across the pavement one from another. And so I would say that secrecy between huts was absolute.
We only knew the girls that we worked with or the officers who were in charge of on our watch. We didn't know other people. We didn't know what was going on in the next room. And it wasn't until well after the war that I knew about Hut 11 and the bomb machines. I had absolutely no idea about it, although I wasn't that far away from it. It was so secret.
Well, actually, I worked in Hut 11, and I walked past Hut 6 four times a day. Coming, lunch, going back after lunch, at night, finished. And it wasn't until I came here to be a guide that I knew that we were speaking on the phone to this other hut, which was literally not even a stone's throw away, but none of us knew it was that secret. On a rather different note, but the same theme, in January 1944, all of us who'd been in civilian billets were put into a newly built camp just round the back here. And the huts contained about 20 of us, I suppose, and we were all from different departments. And even though we were all using the same hut to sleep in, none of us ever spoke about our work. It was that secret. And even well after the war, the girl who was in the bed next to me had gone back to Cheltenham, to GCHQ, to work, and I went and had lunch with her one day, not very many years ago, and she still would not tell me what she was doing.
Lovely. I think we've probably covered that one, haven't we? Right. Okay. Did you feel a weight of responsibility? Were you excited by it, bored by it? How did you feel?
Well, because I had a brother in the Merchant Navy and I was dealing with U-boat signals, I was very interested, of course. And it was very close to me that the work we did was important, very important. And actually, after the war, long time after the war, I had a couple of American friends come to visit me, and they were asking me about Bletchley Park. There was a man at the next table, and he got up a bit later, and he came and said, "I was in the Navy for so many years, and I just want to thank you and all the people at Bletchley Park for the work you do."
How did you feel 30 years later when you discovered that you'd helped change the course of the war?
I was angry. Here was this man writing about everything we had done when we had been sworn that we must never, ever talk about it. That was my first feeling. After that, I thought, well, it's been done, it's been done. And yes, I'll describe it then. But my first feeling was of anger.
My view about it was that I kept quiet for all 30 years, 34 for me. I was going to start now. And it was a very long time before I did, in fact, pluck up courage. I think it was a result of having reunions, which we did after 1979. We had annual reunions where we were all encouraged to talk about what we'd been doing, but we could all put the whole picture together and there was something to talk about.
Ruth.
I was only going to add that for me, and I think for most of us, it was our first job. It was my first job after leaving the sixth form. And I knew that women did war work. And for me, it was war work. It was only exciting. People often say, wasn't it exciting? The answer was no. It was just another job, literally humdrum, if you like, drums going round. The only exciting part was when the people in Hut 6 had received a stock that you happened to have sent in, and it worked out that they put it onto their Enigma machines and Typex machines, and Clear German came out. They would then say, "Job up," and that message would come to your petty officer, who would say, "Job up, strip," which meant pull all the wheels and plugs off and start again. and you had a feeling of elation that although you haven't got anything literally to do with the nuts and bolts of code breaking, that you had done the job accurately, because accuracy was absolutely 100%. You know, if you got a wire plugged into the wrong socket, or you haven't looked at a brush in a drum and it touched another brush, you had a short circuit, and then your petty officer would come later and say, if you hadn't been careless, we might have brought that job up earlier. So you had a sense of responsibility, but otherwise it was fairly straightforward, just another job. And in fact, I have to add, by the way of interest, that after I was married, and some years later, when we needed to augment our income, we took a franchise on the Bendix Laundrette. So there was I in the shop watching 12 machines, drums going round and round.
Thank you very much. How many Y stations were there? Many, I think, yes. Forgive me, I think I'll probably do this one. There were a lot of Y stations. Initially, we talked about five: Chatham, Denmark Hill, Sandridge, Yersendorf, Scarborough, and Winchester, but many, many more were built around the UK. But then, of course, the Y service also spread abroad. Malta, Gibraltar, North Africa, Singapore. And Singapore moved to Colombo. Colombo then moved to Kilindini in Mombasa. There were absolute mass of these stations there. And those were just the ones dealing with Morse. Then think of all the Y stations dealing with voice as well. It's a lot. Forgive me, I can't give you a better answer. How did you make sure there were no short circuits?
Because we had iPod tweezers. And when we stripped the machine, we had to look at every single little brush. There were brushes behind, four little brushes behind every letter of the alphabet. Each brush had 19 filaments in it, and you had to make sure not one tiny, tiny filament was touching anything metallic at all. That was how you got short. So you had to watch for it.
And there was only 104 brushes on each wheel.
It's not just a pretty face.
What was it like to be a billeter? Could you tell people? How did you answer questions and that sort of thing whilst you were in the billets?
Very good question. I think I was rather flippant, and my landlady in Loudon in particular would sometimes ask, what have you been doing today? And I'd simply say, oh, terribly boring old secretarial job, and followed up by, have you been listening to whatever it was on the radio? And brush it off like that. And afterwards, as you rightly remember, I did keep in touch. They never asked. They were very good. I think it was partly because two of their sons were in the forces and they were used to being discreet.
I did ask somebody who lived in Bletchley, when they saw these thousands of people in Bletchley, what did they think about it? And his answer was that, well, we knew it was something to do with the war, so we never said anything.
That's right. I was going to say that actually in Eastcote, we had two blocks, A block where we lived and B block where we worked. And through that passage, there was, at right angles, a pathway going across where civilians walked backwards and forwards, seeing us go from one building to another every day. But during the war, there was this phrase, hush, hush. Usually, people didn't ask any further than that. I think the most difficult person to deal with was my mother. She was very different. She said, well, you can tell me, you know, I'm your mother. And I thought, oh, yes, it'd be all round permanent.
One more question, please. Jean, you mentioned that the messages were going from Colombo to Melbourne. Was that because Melbourne was a particular headquarters at the time?
We actually sent them to FRU Melbourne, which was Fleet Reconnaissance Unit, I think, though I never learned what the R was. Maybe you know, do you? Wait. You know.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, you know Narson. It was FRU Mel.
I think it would probably be Fleet Radio Unit.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't radio?
I don't think. Well, not much.
I don't know.
I wouldn't guess. And through EF, which was Eastern Fleet, and through Pacific, PAC, and that went to Honolulu. But That's why I didn't say it, because I didn't know what FRU really meant. Nobody told me.
And that will have been fairly typical. Right. Okay. Gwendolyn and Betty will be signing books after you've had some tea. But thank you for supporting this event. Ladies and gentlemen, can you please thank Ruth Foreman?
Still to come in the Bletchley Park Presents series is Gary Ayton on Sunday the 19th of October. He's the curator of the Crime Museum, once known as the Black Museum. It's the Metropolitan Police's archive, deemed too disturbing to allow in anyone but serving police officers. And Family Fun Wednesdays continue throughout the school holidays with Sneaky Cyber Secrets and the Top Secret Room, both new this year. A touching story which emerged during Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cambridge's visit was the inspirational figure looked up to by the architect behind the transformation of Bletchley Park, Jamie Price. She bumped into veteran Jane Fawcett, who met the Duchess inside the newly restored Hut 6. It turns out they go way back.
I'm going round with my student here, who's now the architect.
I know, it's a wonderful connection, isn't it?
Very good.
Jane's helped recreate this.
I've been talking to her about it. I mean, I think it's wonderful that it's here. Last time I was here, it was all derelict.
I think it's a lovely tribute to people like you, isn't it, that much younger generations now understand what conditions you had to work in.
And, yes, and exactly.
The hardships that you had, really.
Exactly. Incredible cold. We had no heating in the huts at all, except these frightful little metal, you wouldn't call them boilers, what would you call
little
them,
stoves.
Jane? Stoves, yes, that smoked, of course, gave out no heat at all. But we put them religiously on in the winter if we had time to. And in the summer it was boiling hot with this enormous amount of roof space. No way of cooling it down. Couldn't open the windows because it was all so secret. Nobody could know what we were doing.
And where did you work?
I worked in Hut 6, mostly. Partly in Hut 8, but mostly in Hut 6.
And what were you working on?
I was working on the Enigma, on the translations, allocating where they ought to go. In other words, what priorities they ought to have, because I spoke German. And so I had this relationship with this thing coming out of the tape, whether it was going to be so important it had to go straight to Whitehall, or whether it was going to be something very minor about somebody's knickers having broken or something, because somebody had to make that first allocation as to what was going to be done with it. So I and many others were in Hut 6 racing through all this material.
So you were working with Gordon Welshman then?
Well, I mean, he was one of the codebreakers, so he was much more important than me. I mean, they were so wonderful, the codebreakers, and they were on such a high the whole time. They could hardly speak. They were in such agonies. The agonies about, nearly every new code they were trying to break was just so agonising, because every minute meant thousands of people's lives were at risk. And so we couldn't really touch there. We couldn't even get near them because they were in such a state of controlled ecstasy, turning to agony, turning to ecstasy. They were an extraordinary crowd, unique people.
I think that's part of the problem. A lot of people think Enigma was just one thing that had to be broken once, and that was
all the time. I mean, they were always changing it, and then the Germans were getting new ideas. And we usually broke it because they made some silly mistake. Somebody was lazy and didn't complete the job or put in the wrong letter or something, and that just gave us a clue and we were able to get into it.
Can you tell us some more about the holes you were saying about between the huts there were the holes?
Our communication with Hut 6 and Hut 3 was through a little hole in the wall, which you know all about, I'm sure, but apparently it isn't there anymore because Janie couldn't find it.
We could find it on one hut and we couldn't find the corresponding hole on the other hut, so I was quite keen to recreate it. But actually then I realised that we didn't have any information about the physicality of what it looked like, so we didn't have enough information to recreate it anyway.
I see.
So I'd love to sit down and sketch it and see if we can get to the bottom of what it should look like.
As I say, in Hut 3, the translators were all in a circle, round a supporting... I suppose now I come to think of it, it was probably a chimney, really, that supported some frightful worn-out old stove. But anyway, there was something which held this circular structure up. and they had their chairs round it because they wanted to be able to pass the papers from one to the other. And at one side of it, there was a big hole about table level. I mean, the bottom of it was about table level. And on it was a basket held up with some old bits of string and that kind of thing. It was very, very ad hoc. And all these vitally important messages going to people like Churchill got into this little basket.
So was it like a wire basket or a cane basket?
As far as I remember, it was one of those little wire baskets.
Yeah.
You know, usual army issue. And I used to just shout through it, and I knew all the translators, of course, and I used to say, I've got something for you, Gordon, and then Gordon would appear the other side of it and he'd pull the thing through, and then I knew it was in good hands, and vice versa. You heard a voice saying Jane, and you ran along, and there was something very exciting coming through the other way. So it was all on a very personal level.
And would you have had any interaction from one room to another, from the people working
in other rooms?
Oh,
yes, we were always running up and down, of course. But the people who were rather didn't want to be disturbed were the code breakers, because they were the deep thinkers.
And did they have one particular allocated place in the hut?
Yes, they did. And it was right up in hut 6, at the far end on the right.
Uh-huh. What is the connection between you two?
Jane was my tutor when I studied building conservation. And Jane ran the course at the Architectural Association in London and also was a specialist in historic flooring.
Well, I had no idea Janie was working here until I ran into her.
Yes.
And then unmistakably there she was. Yes. And then I discovered she'd been working here.
For 4 years, yes. And I'd seen your name on the list. And I'd made efforts to try to get your contact details so I could contact you.
Well, you did have my telephone number, Jane.
Well, in the end, yes, I did, because Ken said, you've got your old Filofax, it must be in there.
Exactly.
And sure enough, in the bottom of my wardrobe, I did have my old Filofax.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant link that you wouldn't have known when studying that you would end up here.
Not at all.
Well, I didn't teach my students about Bletchley, of course.
No.
Why should I?
I imagine at that time you couldn't still, could you?
No, I wasn't allowed to. It's perfectly right. And I had to get out of the Official Secrets Act in order to give a lecture about what I was doing at Bletchley.
Really?
Yes. Well,
I
rang up some old boffin and said, I have signed the Official Secrets Act. I have been asked to give a lecture to the SAS about my time at Bletchley. And I thought, well, I must just tell somebody I'm going to do it, because I haven't spoken about it for about 30 years. Yeah. And so I rang up the boffin and said, that's perfectly all right. Yeah. You're not likely to say anything that will be of any interest. So I thought, well, that's bloody rude. So I said, well, I would need that in writing.
Absolutely.
So I got a letter absolving me, because the Official Secrets Act, you sign it for life.
Yes.
You're not told when you sign it that you have signed it for life, but you have. And the penalties for... None of us knew this, of course, and it wasn't why we didn't speak. The penalties for speaking out when you have signed it were apparently quite grave. So it was lucky that I got this boffin in time.
We still have veterans now who still will refuse to speak about what they did. They still feel that they can't.
Well, Mavis Beattie, who has just died, who was on that plaque there because she worked in the cottage with Dilly, she didn't talk much about it. Until suddenly, when the first article appeared, serialised in the Sunday Times.
Winterbottom.
Was it Winterbottom the first? Yes. Yes. She realised, as most of us did, that if the Sunday Times knew about it, it must be all right for us to know about it.
Did you know her during the war?
Very well.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, I just knew her when she was here during the war, just. But I knew her very well afterwards. She was one of Ted's great friends.
Yes, indeed, and through the Garden History Society.
And as I say, there was this touching photograph of them both sitting, talking about the Garden History Society, and about a week later they were dead.
Yes.
Both of them.
Yes.
They both looked so well. So I'm very glad that she's there.
Yes, and I think she's been quite influential in instigating the conservation landscape.
I'm sure she has.
Which is going to be implemented in the future.
Well, it's great if it's being done with her influence, because she really was knowledgeable.
Well, I mean, they've already started here. Gone is that horrible tarmac car park.
It has improved immensely since I was here, certainly.
Is this like you remember it was during the war?
I remember tripping over large blocks of stone, trying to get round the lake, in order to get something to eat in the house. So I was right down there somewhere in Hut 6.
Yes.
Nowhere near this at all.
Yes.
In where is the
building that's now gone?
Behind us.
The lake's behind you, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So we must have been right over down there somewhere.
Yes.
And that includes Hut 3 and Where is Hut 8 now?
Hut 8's just behind you.
Oh, yes. Well, Hut 8 might have been connected with us. I can't really remember.
The numbers went with the huts when they moved to different areas. Right. Yes, so that's why, you know, we can have people who were in Hut 3 here and Hut 3 when it was in Block D.
Yes. Well, as I say, the room I worked in mostly in Hut 6 was a very large room. It ran half the length of the hut and about half the width. I don't know what the measurements of the huts are. I can't remember. What are they?
Very good question. I can't remember either.
I mean, I think the room I worked in probably took up about a quarter of Hut 6.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes, I only know in square metres, and so it wouldn't really mean anything anyway. How did you come to be here in the first place? What was your way in? How were you
here,
invited?
Got a letter from a friend. My greatest friend, actually, who had somehow got here, been invited here, and she wrote and said, "We're desperately busy, Jane. We desperately need people like you to help us. Why don't you come?"
Were you fresh from school?
Yes, fresh from school.
Yes.
And when I got here, of course, it was full of my friends, because they'd all been invited the same way. Quite extraordinary.
And was it largely because of you were a linguist?
I think the German thing was very influential. But I had just done a secretarial course also, so that, I suppose, was thought to be useful. And I did know a lot of the people here, and I was somebody who was prepared to come and give my life for it, which is what we all were prepared to do.
So were you interviewed in any way?
When I came?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. And when I came, I was 18, and what was the point of interviewing another girl of 18 who didn't know anything about it anyway?
So you just came and started straight away without any...
Yes, absolutely,
visit.
Thrown in at the deep end.
Signed the Official Secrets Act on your first day.
Quite right. I went to see Travis, I think it was Travis when I first arrived, who was the head of the show. And I was interviewed by a man called Milner Barry, who was head of Hut 6, who was a King's Cambridge man and very knowledgeable, very good mathematician, very good chess player. Never interviewed a woman in his life, I don't think. He hadn't got the slightest idea what to say to me or anything, except he knew I was a person who might be put on a seat and get on with it. And so he said, "Well, I think we'll go and see Travis." So we went to see Travis. And he said, "Well, I want you to sign the Official Secrets Act, Jane." Didn't ask me anything about myself at all. And there was another 18-year-old sitting on another seat. And we were the people who did it, just because we were there.
And how many years were you here for?
5 years. Anybody else would have done it if they happened to find themselves in that position.
So when you left at the end, was that pretty much the end of activity in Bletchley at the time?
Well, yes, I suppose it probably was. But I was asked to go and learn Japanese and do the Japanese war. So I went up to London at that point and did learn Japanese and did translate Japanese messages.
Why don't you talk about the incident where you got a message which actually helped to destroy the...
The Bismarck. Yeah, that was my most exciting time, I suppose. I happened to be on duty, and most things here happened in that way. Either you were on duty or you weren't. And if you were on duty, you took what came to you. If there was something needing to be done, you did it. And I suddenly got a thing on my plate coming out of the Enigma machine which said Brest on it. And I happened to know, because everybody knew, that the main part of our fleet was somewhere in the channel trying to intercept the Bismarck, which was the Germans' newest and most important battleship. And I just thought that that might be very important, so I read it right through. And this is now common news. Everybody knows that that was how we found out about it. One of the senior officers in the German army, I think it must have been, because I was really in the army section, telegraphed the captain of the Bismarck saying, "I'm worried about my son who's on board and I want to know where you're going." And we all thought she was going back into the fjords, so we were all lined up to stop her doing that. What she was actually doing was streaking away down into Brest. So we got her. The whole fleet was turned round and off they went in pursuit, sunk her.
My stepfather was helping service the Swordfish on HMS Victorious.
Really?
21 years old on his first ever journey.
Well, there you are. I mean, we were all in it. We all did what we could.
Yes.
And that was what I did. And it was very, very exciting because it did save thousands of lives. But not before they'd already sunk the Hood. And they had this marvellous amount of armoury, didn't they? Yeah. The latest possible guns and everything. So they could really sink more or less anything if they decided to.
And in the end, they were crippled by ancient biplanes.
Was that how we
it
finally
was the
got
swordfish
them?
Yes. That damaged the rudder and meant that the Navy could actually hunt her down in the end and sink her.
Well, it seems extraordinary when you look at these funny old things, which is us, that we actually did it, doesn't it?
Well, all of you were one tiny cog in a massive machine.
That's exactly
everyone
right.
Here, so many of you that I speak to say, oh, I did nothing important here. No, every single person who was here was part of that machine, and without all of you, we wouldn't be here now.
And they were all working incredibly hard. I mean, we regularly worked 12-hour shifts, which isn't very hard for an architect, but...
I was doing that yesterday.
But I worked 24 hours shift over the Bismarck thing because I just happened to get it. And so we did work. By today's standards, I would say we were workaholics. And then we had to get back to our digs, which meant driving through the night in the dark. Everything was blacked out. I was said to be carrying a hammer in my pocket, but actually it was a torch. But you could have been, I was all on my own, could have been accosted easily.
So would there have been any site lighting here?
No, I don't think any. I mean, it's a total miracle. Why, nobody tried to get in, nobody knew we were here. How could they not have known? I mean, we had this huge number of motor bicycles, for example, coming in and out all the time. All the radio stuff, of course, we managed to get through without anybody intercepting it. How did we do it? It wasn't us. I mean, if we had all talked all the time for 24 hours a day, we wouldn't have got very much out. By modern methods, it must have been quite easy to find out there was some sort of thing going on at Bletchley, wasn't it?
Just people knew to keep quiet, didn't they?
I just simply don't understand how it...
Hush, hush.
Well, you've put the labels back, haven't you, saying, don't speak, or whatever they say?
Yes.
I remember those. I mean, there was a sort of general accent saying people shouldn't talk. What I did say to that sweet Duchess, who I thought was so good at her job and so charming, and I said, well, don't forget that we were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. It may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives.
Absolutely.
We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to meet you, and thank you for your service.
That's all right. I always enjoy talking.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes.
Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.